Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Josh Hong, a multi-awarded global executive chairman, investor, and serial entrepreneur. Josh, we've had a prior discussion, and you were sharing so much of where you wanted to take Curely, and also you talked about your investment history, your entrepreneurial history, and so on, and just so much that you've done in terms of your career, and I'd like to maybe get into some of that work again and perhaps in a little bit more detail in this interview. Dig into some of the projects that you're working on now. So that's sort of the focus of this discussion. Anyways, thank you so much for coming in today and just sharing so much with our audience.
Sure. It's my pleasure and honor to be here.
Now, you know, you did some work with Arthur Andersen worldwide, and are there any useful lessons that you think you could share that would be useful to the audience from that work?
that's a very good question. When I joined Arthur Andersen, that was back in 1993. The firm has grown from just a small IT unit within Arthur Andersen, the global organization. It was one of the dominant accounting consultancies based in Chicago. I would say at the time preeminent. No one came close to being in that position, and they had this IT consulting unit called Andersen Consulting. And that organization grew to be about 18,000 people, and I joined them, and I was with them for several years, and they practically, I think, grew by another 80%-ish. So I went through some incredible growth experience being in part of a private partnership that was doing some very large scale IT consulting projects at the time. And if you kind of go back to early 1990, that's when the concept of decentralized decision making, mainly driven by globalization, kind of started to happen. So back then, most of the business logic was stored in mainframe and was centrally managed, but all the regional offices needed their decision or business logic to be handled faster. So the computer systems was basically being broken down to little tiny pieces. Back then, we used to call that client-server technology. So there was a tremendous amount of projects that were happening. I mean, it was sweeping the country, and Andersen Consulting was one of the four front runner of making those sort of computer system consulting projects everywhere. And also, at the time, Andersen Consulting was very big on what they call BPO, or process. I think O may stood for operation back then. It's essentially outsourcing to places like India or the Philippines. And so I joined the firm, and I was traveling constantly because it was a private partnership. The way we conducted ourselves as quote-unquote consultants were really, really cool to me. I grew up mostly in the Midwest, a small town in Indiana, and getting into this cool job in downtown Chicago, working on multiple projects, and being labeled as consultant was just a quite an experience for me. Couple major takeaways. One, I learned how to communicate my thoughts in a way that people can relate to. It's not about what I thought that was important when I was in a meeting, but it's how I communicated my thoughts. So I learned how to communicate effectively as a consultant. I think that was a very, very good lesson for me at a deeply personal level. I think the second thing that I learned was the role of technology. I began to see technology as not just enabler of certain business functions, but because, around the mid-1995-ish time, the internet starting to really, really take its place. And all of a sudden, then these corporations were starting to use internet as a way to sell products and services, and they called it e-commerce. And it was just a brand new way. And I started to see some startups out in the Bay Area start doing some really, really cool stuff like eBay, Amazon, Yahoo's of the world at the time. So I saw what was happening, and then I started to see technology as a real weapon or competitive weapon, even for small companies to really compete effectively with the large corporations. So that was an enormous learning for me, and really appreciated my sort of experience during that time. I worked like crazy and party like crazy during the weekend, and you know, very young people doing some cool technology stuff. So I couldn't ask for anything better than my experience at Arthur Andersen during that time. I think after the firm became a publicly traded company, now it's called Accenture, I think the culture has transformed radically differently. Now it's a very different firm or a different company or a publicly traded company. But at least back then, it was just a lot of fun. Great place to be in.
You know, Josh, that's just an amazing background, and I can see how that's informed your success throughout your career. You also did some work at Deutsche Bank. Is just there any other useful lessons you can share from Deutsche Bank?
Yeah, my experience at Deutsche Bank was probably not the best kind. I mainly learned what not to do. One, I didn't stay at the bank very long time. And number two, it's mainly because I just couldn't, let's say, either fit into the culture or I couldn't agree with what was happening on Wall Street at the time. And what I mean by that is really kind of driven by two forces. Force number one is related to how Deutsche Bank got put together. I mean, Deutsche Bank is the largest bank in the land of in Germany. And they decided to create this universal bank. And so then they start buying all these smaller investment banking shops, mainly in UK and also US. So they bought Bankers Trust. They bought Alex Brown, which is a very highly regarded tech banking firm based in Boston, and among others. And their entire M&A department, which was the area that I was hired into, was mainly, I think, run by a bunch of ex-Morgan Stanley bankers that they poached away. So the corporate culture at the time was such that there was no culture. It was just a bunch of mercenaries cobbled together by the senior bankers in London, and they were all directed by guys in Germany. But we were, there we were in New York, and I was also placed in Hong Kong for a few months. And I think my bosses changed maybe two or three times while I was there. And each time there's a new boss, there's a different kind of people or the cronies of that banker kind of came in. And so it was a highly unsettling environment. So I was having a really, really rough time fitting in. I think the second thing that I couldn't really accept was, here I am. I just got my MBA. I was happy with my education. I was very eager to apply and grow. And yet, the entire investment banking culture of Wall Street was very much about money, and then it was about bonuses. It's about how quickly you get transaction done, and the teamwork mattered to the extent that how fast and how much money you made, but not much else, because there wasn't enough time for anything else. A few months into my experience, I realized that I hardly enjoy talking to anyone on the floor. I did not like my boss. I did not enjoy my work. And I couldn't agree with this singular focus on money. And it's not like the bank was manufacturing anything. There's no sense of product. And probably not even about service. It was just transaction orientation all the way. So as soon as I realized that, you know, here I was, I spent a couple of years as a consultant, and then got myself a this hotshot MBA degree, and then working for at the time one of the rising stars on Wall Street as a very aspiring universal banking group, a Deutsche Bank, and then I realized that I couldn't see investment banking being my career for a very long time. So I said, if I am not going to stay a very long time, then what is the point in wasting a day at this bank? Let me just eject myself out and then do something that for once that I'm really passionate about. Because I spent up until that point, I think I was maybe like 29. I try to prepare myself to get into top business school. And once I got my MBA, then I realized that I had to pay off my tuitions and I had to build my brand new career post MBA. And I needed a certain title on my resume to make it look more presentable. But once I realized that was just really, something that I didn't enjoy pursuing and I no longer really wanted to do that, then I just came to my full realization that I wanted to leave. So I spoke to my dad. Of course, him being a Korean American father, he was very proud of me, being in the very well known banking institutions out there. And then once I told him that I was gonna leave for creating my own game company, he literally thought that I was nuts. And I think I was at the time because I, more than anything, I just hated my life. So it wasn't even about having a great unicorn billion-dollar startup idea and trying to chase that. It was quite the opposite. It was more like I was repelled by the whole experience that I thought I needed, I wanted it. Once I understood that that wasn't what I was looking for, then I just wanted to remove myself from that. So that was really the kind of cause. So my experience at Deutsche Bank was really, it comes down to one thing. There's not enough time and energy in my life to pursue something that I don't want to anymore. And that was a big inflection point in my life at the time.
Now, you just mentioned that you went into gaming and then you also got into creating asset trading and currency platforms. Is there any, maybe one, two, or three key lessons that you want to share from that experience with gaming and asset trading currency platforms?
Yeah, so that was just an incredible experience for me too. It just came out of the woodwork at the time. I didn't expect any of those things to happen to me, even plan. So, here I was, year 2001, the economy got crushed by the September 11th. So, but that year, 2011, I spent most of year 2000 to write up my business plan, which was getting into online gaming business. At the time, I was more into subscription-based online gaming business. Didn't really understand or how to even crack into the free-to-play mode. But nonetheless, 2011 came, and I started to execute all the things that I wrote down in my business plan. And I couldn't get anything done because the market was just so cooled off to the point where it was dormant. No capital going in and out of anyone's pocket. It was just kind of sitting there. And I was eating into my savings, so it was a very difficult time. So nonetheless, my game was launched, and it was a very simple golf game. And then it was Initially, we started with a subscription. We couldn't quite make it to be profitable at all. In fact, no one really bought anything. So, and because of there's a, you know, initial subscription requirement, people weren't joining. So, you know, me and a couple other guys in my company, we said, you know what, hell with this. Let's just kind of make it free and see how it goes. We made it free. We got a lot more users, but we needed money. So then we said, well, we want to put some advertising, but we couldn't because no one wanted to put advertising in online golf game at the time. So, and there wasn't even a sufficient or credible, you know, ad display model back then, especially inside a game. So then we started selling these golf balls, and that's how we started to make money. I mean, we still couldn't turn the game into a profitable thing, but nonetheless, I started to do some transactions and start toying with selling golf balls. But in order to create the demand, we started just having these events. And then in order to have effective events, then we needed to create some community curations. So then we hired some community curators, and that's how we kind of grew that business. The asset trading business is a really fascinating thing because, like, around 2002, 2003-ish, free-to-play concept really took a hold in South Korea. I would say mainly South Korea because there was just torrential number of free online games were coming into the marketplace. And this is one of those kind of, you know, very strange phenomenon at the time where, for some reason, Koreans loved online games. And it's not just any kind of online games, but it's a hardcore role-playing games, difficult to make nonetheless because there's so much demand. Probably, I would say, a couple hundred game companies starting to create essentially the same thing. So around 2003, there's so many games were in the market where gamers had too many choices, and then game companies had to make it everything free just to get more players. So then you see all this oversupply of games, and then gamers with the lots of game choices. So then some gamers would literally spend 14, 15 hours a day playing probably 2-3 games at the same time. And when a gamer spends that kind of time, the game becomes his reality. And then the actual reality becomes almost secondary. And then when you spend that kind of time and give the commitment to your quote-unquote reality in your game, then you start to have certain mindset that this character's mine, this land is mine, or this armor is mine, this castle is mine. And that concept of ownership really I'm starting to translate into virtual property ownership. It really started with online games in a very large scale. Then these gamers will start to trade because let's say you got level, you know, 150 character in one game and you want to move up to the next game, but you probably spend about 400 or 500 hours of your time invested in creating that or growing the character. So that character means something to other people because it takes that kind of hours to grow it. So then the gamers will sell those account usually with the password on eBay and what have you. So I started to notice that there were lots of gamers willing to trade in virtual assets. And I think around 2004, it was already probably $300 to $400 million transaction value, all black market, no regulation. It just gamers either trade them over the counter or they will create their own website and just trade them inside a forum. So there are two companies became rather big in South Korea. They're kind of half of the market each. So then I decided to create exactly the same type of business but for Chinese market. China at the time, the internet penetration wasn't as high, and they didn't have the high speed internet accessible throughout the entire continent. So the online gaming was a little bit of a luxury for many, many gamers. Nonetheless, you started to see a lot of gamers in some of the tier one cities like Beijing, Shanghai, Shenzhen, and Hangzhou. So I flew out to Shanghai. My brother was living in Shanghai at the time, so I kind of lived off of one of his guest rooms. And then I created this company called ItemStar. And that's how that business got started. And I raised money from a few investors, and I grew that business to about 65 full-time employees in Shanghai. Not really knowing what was happening, just I was sort of thinking that, well, you know, if this type of gain asset trading business can take off in Korea, I'm sure similar business can take off in China, but it would be probably 100 times bigger. My hunch was essentially correct. It's just the way I approached the business, and then as soon as I launched it, then there were probably about half dozen Chinese competitors came about, and their approach was very different from mine. There were a lot more Chinese approach, whereas I made a few critical assumptions that, you know, these payments for handling virtual assets, can be done using credit cards or bank wire transfer, which proved to be actually wrong. So my big takeaway in that business was probably two. Number one, when as an entrepreneur, when you start to see something happening, but you couldn't quite explain or justify in your head, you don't have a right, let's say, set of data or data points to fully justify, but your gut tells you that you know, this is going somewhere. I would I learned through my experience that it's far better to go with your gut than using too much of your brain that always is looking for more data points. There's never enough data points when you make a decision. So I learned how to trust my instinct and also train my gut instinct constantly. That was an important kind of a lesson for me. I think the second lesson that I learned was, at least when you operate in China, you really cannot make an assumption based on your experience or your experiences and successes that were achieved in markets outside of China. China is essentially a bubble. And in order to be successful in China, the combination in the DNA of a particular startup has to be Chinese. If there's any element of foreignness there, it's going to create issues. After that experience where my competitor, how quickly competitor just kind of came about, and how quickly also they came to, almost bully, my business using their very indigenous kind of Chinese method. I've learned that it's far better to work with a really indigenous Chinese team if you're going to do something in China. That's usually not very possible as a foreigner. But if you must, then it's better to really go with a very local Chinese team and then follow their approach as opposed to foreign approach, which almost never really works in China.
You know, something that sounds really interesting, you have the South Korean connection, you have this North American and European connection as well. And you also mentioned that your brother was in Shanghai, I believe. So what are your family roots? How did this global sort of enterprise thinking rise in you, from a young age to where you are now? Was your family very much entrepreneurial in Korea? You're fluent in multiple languages. How did that all come about in this kind of dispersion of your family?
I do come from a family of entrepreneurs. My father was an orphan during Korean War. So he became an entrepreneur when he was like, I think 9 or 10, selling popsicles and, you know, whatever he put down, kind of rummage through the street, and he will kind of sell that off on, you know, the other part of the town. He himself became a quite successful manufacturer of metal goods or stuff that require a lot of the metal processing or manufacturing processing. So I suppose all my siblings and myself kind of benefit from that lineage in a way. But I think for me, when my parents decided to immigrate to the U.S., they brought us to a very small town in Indiana, and it is a kind of environment where there's no racial diversity whatsoever. I mean, it is 99.9% white Caucasian, extremely politically right-wing type of uber Christian type of community, population maybe 35,000 people. So as we were growing up, we all developed a certain mindset that we didn't want to be there, although we very much enjoy being in Indiana. It's just that for our career, we would rather, go outside, which we did. And so I think our childhood planted a seed in me and my brother and my sister to be very sort of a global minded, or at least let's get out of Indiana and see what we can find. So we had this attitude of explorer, or we were constantly looking to discover something new. So I think that has a lot to do with it. My brother ended up joining GE at a very young age. I think he graduated from Purdue, and then within a year, then he joined GE, and he married his college sweetheart, who was Chinese descent. They are now married and have two kids, and GE or GE Plastics at the time send them off to the global, I think, future leader training program. So it was like a 4-year training program where they were stationed in one country for about 6 to 12 months, and so they were constantly being kind of shipped around. So they were in Shanghai for roughly about 3 years after they completed the program. Then they were working for various a division within GE Plastic. Today they both work for still GE. My brother is part of GE Health, and his wife is part of GE Energy. We've used each other's kind of location as a ways to help each other. Every time I go to China, I would stay in his place, and he also helped me a lot making introductions. I guess we grew up as a kind of Gen X kind of global trying kind of immigrant kind of folks. So I would say that's very much part of our ethos.
I see. I mean, I can see that entrepreneurship is in your DNA. I mean, it's obvious every time I have a discussion with you. Now, you've taken this leap from industry to being an entrepreneur. Can you define what are the attributes or qualities that make for a successful entrepreneur? Maybe just even a few items?
Yeah, I mean, there are many. I've grown to really appreciate some of those fine qualities. I had many doubts about who I was or why I am certain way while I was growing up. But a couple of things. I think the first thing that comes to mind is certain attitude of, I call that acceptance, or people call that open mind, or flexibility, or agility. Entrepreneur is essentially at its core, it's really an arbitrager. It is a kind of person who's willing to trade something that has a very little value to you, but willing to trade it with something else that has a higher value. But being able to recognize that delta in that trade and then really take advantage of that before anyone else. So in order to recognize those arbitrage opportunities, you need to have open mind. You kind of have to get yourself outside of a box and then see the world from a very different vantage point. So I think that attitude of, you know what, I see things a little differently, or I respectfully disagree, or you know what, I have an idea. It's that type of open mind is absolutely important for a successful entrepreneur. I think the second thing that I really also like or appreciate, which many entrepreneurs may disagree, is willing to embrace my own solitude. That is, because I am walking on the path that I think it's right for myself and no one else, I'm willing to be alone. I am willing to be lonely. And in fact, I enjoy being in that solitude and then walking the walk, talking the talk. Some people may call that as courage or independent mindedness or self-reliance, or I call that, you know, embracing his own solitude. I see that quality perhaps not all successful entrepreneurs, but some of the very, very best entrepreneurs out there. Literally, who just doesn't give a shit. Not because he wants to make a statement, but genuinely, he just disagrees with everyone else. And he's just so in his own universe that nothing else matters. And I think that that sort of embracing one's solitude is actually, to me, it's one of the very important qualities. I think the third quality is certain propensity to accept one's frugality. And again, there are many entrepreneurs who disagree with me. And that is, willing to go very low, willing to not spend a lot of money, or willing to go very stingy at times, willing to be able to survive with not a lot of money. And in fact, knowing that it actually doesn't take a lot of money to be happy. And then once, you know, that realization hits, then all of a sudden, you know, money becomes sort of, another sort of a currency in life, like knowledge or wisdom or a certain mindset or information. And it is just simply that. Just to give an example, when I left Deutsche Bank and then tried to become an entrepreneur, first 3 years were process of what I call unlearning. Because when I, throughout my 20s, I had this mindset that in order to have a cool lifestyle, you know, I need to have a certain type of cars, I need to have a certain type of home, I need to have a certain type of girlfriend, I need to wear a certain type of clothes. And those became my own mantra. And in order to, you know, sort of kind of keep living the life that I thought was cool, I was, you know, basically spending all this money. And during that process of quote-unquote unlearning, I realized that those were all a very, almost wrong social program. And so in my mind, I started to say, no, I don't need to have those things. I'm quite okay with many, many things that I thought was important. So, I realized that I didn't need a lot of money to actually survive. And I proved that to myself. And then I realized that, oh, wow, I could be very, very competitive when my sort of monthly stipend can be quite low. And I think that helped me to manage my company's budget or certain set of financial assets that we have because I know what it takes to kind of keep a minimum viable type of existence, and I think that mindset, that the determination to go very low and have just enough to survive, but I could go a long time, and which allows me to stay in my game longer than anyone else out there, and that just came with that the mindset of frugality. Like, I don't need a whole lot to survive, and for whatever reason, that stuck with me. And I saw a few other entrepreneurs having a very similar mindset. In fact, after pretty tremendous amount of exit that they have, they still more or less maintain similar lifestyle because it became part of them. And money isn't the object of the game. It's something with the higher calling, and money is just a symbol. And so that would be another sort of characteristics that I saw from other successful entrepreneurs out there.
That's some great experiences that you shared with the audience. And now let's talk about startup success, the steps to startup success, and how do you measure progress. But let's put it in the context of maybe something you're working on right now. And I know in an earlier discussion, you mentioned something called Cuddly. So within that framework, what are the gaps that you saw in that marketplace? What triggered you to design this company to meet that need? How do you vision this rolling out this year or next 2 years? And this really being then a model for startup success and how you measure that progress.
Yeah, so the Cuddly is a mobile-first marketplace for pet owners. Sometimes we call them consumers, and veterinarians out there. This is an international marketplace where any veterinarians with a viable license to practice and their diploma from veterinarian school can join the platform. We will verify them, and then they get to open their online clinic. And on the other side of this two-sided marketplace, pet owners, on the other hand, can create the profiles of their pet. It could be dogs and cats or even birds or any other type of pets out there. And if they have questions they don't want to ask veterinarians, then they simply come and download Cuddly. It spells K-U-D-D-L-Y from any app stores out there. And basically send messages asynchronously or synchronously to veterinarians of their choice. So for example, I have two cats at home, and one of the cats, we call her Choo Choo. Choo Choo is borderline antisocial. And we adopted her 5 years ago from another a friend of ours who, which we didn't know at the time, but who was extremely abusive toward his cat. So when Choo Choo came to us, Choo Choo just basically abhor any human existence out there. I didn't even get to touch her for roughly about 2 years. She wouldn't come to me, and she would only perhaps talk to my girlfriend, now my wife, at the time when she was feeding her. So so that, just it's sort of a one quick background story. So I used Kali to ask a question about how to get close to Choo-Choo. And, you know, this is the type of questions where me as a pet owner, not serious enough for me to go and visit a vet clinic. But it is becoming an issue for me in my household to have that kind of very, very loving and friendly relationship with our pets. So I found a veterinarian. I spent $4 for that consultation. I sent her a message. How can I be sort of better befriended with my cat? And then she came to me, came back to me within 24 hours with basically about what amounts to be a four paragraph length of recommendations. I thought that it was an incredible experience, and I only paid $4 for that, and it was coming out of my credit card. So here in the U.S., there are literally millions of pets out there, but in terms of pet health insurance, there's only 2%. Only 2% of the pets are insured. So you could effectively say that there is, in all practical sense, no insurance coverage. So most pet owners would pay out of their pocket. The second phenomenon is that there's oversupply of veterinarians in America. So there are roughly about 90,000 veterinarians in America who are licensed to practice, another probably 30,000 veterinarians who have lots of experience but who are effectively retired. Combining licensed and then retired veterinarians, there's roughly about 120,000 veterinarians who could use Cuddly to actually supplement their income. And another trend here in America is that a lot of veterinarians, if you think about how much education that they have to achieve in order to become their licensed veterinarian versus how much money they're making, there seems to be a little bit of a disparity there. The going through veterinarian school is, in my opinion, it's similar to actually going through medical school. I mean, the academic rigor and challenge is quite substantial, and the tuition to get through those programs is also substantial. But when you get out, your average income just doesn't amount enough to pay your bills, including if you have mortgage and other expenses. Then if you're in a sort of a heartland of America where predominantly in the Midwest, then most likely you're going to be financially very squeezed. So we decided to create this platform to bring veterinarians to join and then find consumers and pet owners around the world. So this is a pure sort of a supply and demand multiplier, where before everything was controlled by time and space, now we're saying, hey, we could just open this entire thing to the globe, and anyone with the license can join, and anyone with the concerns with their pet can join. So we've been building this system for more than a year. We went live roughly about a month ago. And we today have over 500 veterinarians registered, and we got about almost 200 veterinarians that we verified. So you could find them when you come to our app. And again, the price is essentially not set by us, but it is set by veterinarians themselves. And veterinarians simply set the price based on what the system recommends them based on average pricing, or if they are really busy, where they know that their hours are worth a lot more than what the market suggests, then they could increase the price. Obviously, doing so will decrease the demand, but they're going to be able to make more money for that each hour that they spend on Cuddly. The company is essentially a venture-backed startup, and we have roughly about a dozen employees. A vast majority of them are actually developers, and we are today signing up veterinarians at pet owners around the world.
So that's interesting. It sounds like, in terms of the steps of startup success, you addressed a concern, or you had a question, and that gap between pet owners and the provider of pets care, that there was a gap. There was a need on the provider side that a lot of investment in training and so on, but in essence, not a good return on that training, and the ability to offer and proliferate their advice to a bigger audience. And then on the pet side, on the owner side, having a pet and wanting access to readily accessible, high-level expertise, and at a minimal cost, in essence, and providing that kind of bridge between the two. So you had these two gaps that you were able to address. It sounds like you validated to see if there was, by talking to veterinarians and talking to owners, and also from your own personal experiences, seeing that there was a way to address the gap, and then creating a development team to do what they call a minimum viable product, or MVP, to test out the concept, having some users test that on both sides and seeing that the proof of concept was working, and then getting now customer validation or client validation by maybe going to conferences or shows and seeing what the adoption rate is from the vet side, and then also from the pet owner side, and having built a financial model within this thing, within the larger scope of a business model and a business plan, and being careful in terms of rolling this out so you're not doing an overspend. I see that as sort of the steps you took to create this very successful building and growing enterprise. Do you have anything else to add to that?
Yeah. So ever since Uber came to radically revolutionize the transportation industry, there has seen a proliferation of a mobile marketplace is popping up everywhere. And there are lots of them. And in a way, we are not that different from one of those mobile-first marketplaces out there. You know, and when I talk about marketplace, what I mean by that is like eBay, where it's a two-sided. So there's a supplier of a service or product, and there's a consumer who's consuming those products and services. So the challenge of marketplace is that you need to see the initial transactions, and it needs to come from one side first, and then you work on the other side, and then you work on the opposite side and the other side, and back and forth, and that's how you grew. And some of the best companies out there are in the marketplace. For example, Alibaba in China, one of the largest corporations in the world in terms of market capitalizations, are actually marketplaces. Another classic example would be Amazon. So when we decided to create Cuddly, we had a similar ambition. The pet industry is a $55 billion industry in the U.S. alone. And today, a lot of the growth is actually happening outside of U.S., and there are two demographical reasons why that's happening. Number one, aging society. People are getting old. They're separate from their children, and they want companionship. And the pets are very ideal companion for people who are aging, and that includes everybody. I think the second thing that is also kind of creating that excitement around our industry is that there is a bizarre mismatch of supply and demand between veterinarians and pet owners. For example, in the U.S., the research shows that there's an oversupply of veterinarians. However, if you go to China, there's a gross the undersupply of veterinarians. China has a population of 1.2 billion people, and there is only 10,000 licensed veterinarians out there. Just 10,000. That's it. Because of this, the one-child policy that has been extremely successful for the past couple of decades, many people don't have siblings, and then they kind of grew up with their pets, or for many female millennials, having a pet became more of a social status symbol. So there are lots of pets being adopted, and yet there just simply isn't enough veterinarians to keep up with the demand. So that's what's happening in China. In terms of the veterinarian care insurance, in places like UK, there's over 60% penetration, meaning 60% of the pet owners have some kind of health insurance for their pets. Here in America, it's 2%. It kind of doubled it in the past 18 months. But it's still, in my opinion, pretty insignificant. If you go to places like Asia, hardly any insurance whatsoever. So globally speaking, what I see is just a gross mismatch of supply and demand, and something has to happen. I think ultimately maybe something like AI or some kind of machine learning will kick in, and that's going to radically help pet owners to come up with some kind of smart diagnosis and then apply those information. But that's still ways to go. I think veterinarian care business is probably, conservatively speaking, in my opinion, about 15 years behind that of human medicine. So it's going to take a while. And there is these supply and demand mismatch. And I think our type of marketplace can easily come and really bring that efficiencies in terms of matchmaking between the veterinarians and pet owners. Another pretty interesting factoid here in America in the vet care industry is that if you actually go and visit a veterinarian care clinic, personally speaking, I've probably been there about three times. I never paid, never ever paid below $200 per visit. And there are a couple of reasons why. Number one, it's usually an annual visit. So when I go, my pet tends to have a lot of issues because my pet is not me. I can't sense their pain, their displeasure. So I'm always hypothesizing. So because I am somewhat removed, I kind of let certain symptoms or problems to linger, and it kind of turns into bigger problems. So when I go see a veterinarian, they easily identify a few issues that they need to be treated. So that's one reason why the bill is pretty big. Number two, veterinarians are somewhat trained, if not incentivized, to upsell. So it's not just a selling a consultation, but they usually sell certain type of drugs, leashes, organic pet food, all these things. So they compound. And it became to the point where many pet owners started to really not excited about making that visit because it's financially expensive. But if you live with your pets, there are many small questions that could pop up on a weekly basis. And you just don't spend enough time online, to search for them. And when you do, you get a few conflicting information that it's hard to vet them. So that's why our type of ad can come in and then bridge the gap between that global supply and demand mismatch issue and also although there's an oversupply of veterinarians, it's just the per visit fee is just too high, and it shouldn't be that expensive to ask a simple health-related questions for my pet, and I'm willing to pay $4, $5, $10, and if I could get my answer quickly and efficiently, then it's highly worth it. So that is, in my opinion, at least in this country here in America, one of the strong value proposition of Cuddly.
You know, just fascinating. Then sharing your experiences with this startup, and really, I can see these, you know, maybe six stages of this company, and that is the discovery phase where you're focusing on validating whether there's some kind of meaningful problem and whether there would be anybody interested in some kind of a solution. That's sort of the early discovery part of it, and you did that through research from talking to both sides of the marketplace. And then there's the validation part, where, you know, is there validation that people are interested in a product? And that's through the exchange of money or attention. And then, of course, the third phase, which is efficiency. And that's where you refine your business model, prove the efficiency of gaining, you know, in your case, the vets and also the users of the vets, and then scaling that. So your business model, in essence, are proven. You're increasing the efficiency. You're scaling that to a global platform. And then, of course, there's the profit maximization as you just continue to refine it. And then renewal. Periodically, you're going to have to renew that platform to ensure that it's relevant. And that could be, through what you indicated, maybe adding some machine learning elements sometime in the future. And seeing that machine learning is you indicated earlier, you said that there's got to be some system that it can accommodate more and more information, and maybe machine learning is a possibility in that. So really what you find then is all the different stages that make up your startup success, and people in the audience can look at those stages and say, hey, I've got an idea. I'm going to go through that discovery of that idea. I can validate it to see if people are interested. I can prove my business model. I can scale it. I can try to max my profit and then renew. So I wanted to do is just sort of overview the overall framework that you created, of which Cuddly is just a great example of how you're building success. I guess the question now is you know, you got this Cuddly platform. It's got great validation. You've been able to scale it. Do you see any other things that you want to do to get additional support for it, you know, support from maybe well-known people or other well-known third parties, or any other areas that you think are, provide additional validation points? And then how would you build on that?
Yeah, so there are a couple of things that we are working on. I think the one is that our initial target audience will be millennials who are more likely to be female than male. And we also think that these millennial females are, you know, can be single, or they could be sort of a family household, or single family home household income, or the female mom in the single family home situation. So to reach out to these audience, we are in the process of working with a few Hollywood celebrities who are also passionate pet owners. So we're actually located here in Southern California, very close to Hollywood. So we are in the process of talking to one of the major TV personalities out there. So that will hopefully help us to raise the visibility of the company. I think the second thing that we're also really passionate about is support veterinarians with a very altruistic mission in mind that supports our idea of borderless care. That is, we as a company, we are you know, very much a global company. And so we're in the process of talking to one of the organizations in the East Coast who recruit volunteer veterinarians, and then send them out to remote part of the world and then help animals or certain type of pets out there who have been stranded. And so one of our co-founders, Lucy O'Byrne, she is one of the very well-known veterinarians in Manhattan. She is talking to the organization, and we would like to actually have a system built as within our app that will incent or incentivize the veterinarians on Cuddly to volunteer for these type of programs, and who will then get sent out to the remote parts of the world. So the, you know, we live and breathe our mission. That is to bring that efficiency in curing the mismatch problem between supply and demand of veterinarian care on a global scale. And so we do that as a global marketplace, but at the same time, we want our veterinarians to have an experience that is more than their day-to-day clinic. We want them to be able to fly out to Brazil and then help the animals there, or be able to fly to a Zimbabwe and then help the animals there, and stuff like that. So that then makes our job a lot more meaningful. And you know, as we think through how we want to architect our messaging, which is very much related to what we stand for, that one belief that kind of fuel our company, you know, way more so than sometimes the how much money that we make or how much traffic that we generate, that ethos to us is very important. And we want to work with a Hollywood celebrities or a TV personalities out there, or even social media butterflies, to come and support the mission, and just kind of you know, and support and carry the mission throughout. So so that's basically what we're up to in terms of raising the awareness of the company at the consumer side.
You know, it's amazing what you described here, and I can see they, you know, there's a gentleman by the name of Steve Blank, and something called customer development, and I can see how you're incorporating these ideas of customer discovery, customer validation, company creation, and, you know, this idea of a problem-solution fit, and then following that product-market fit as well, and also incorporating within this Eric Ries and Lean Startup and his minimum viable product, and then Alexander Osterwalder in the business model canvas. And, you know, you're talking about the different sort of segments that you're addressing. And, of course, the business model canvas has, you know, these nine areas about key partners, key activities, key resources, value proposition, audience relationships, distribution channels, audience segments, cost structure, revenue streams. And in this discussion, I can see how you're incorporating these different frameworks to ensure that this is going to be successful. And I'm just sharing that with the audience so that, you know, they can do a reference check on Steve Blank or Eric Ries or Alexander Osterwalder to do further research. And here it is, direct from a leading entrepreneur who's had successful exits and is continuing to have global impact. Do you have any other startups that you maybe just briefly want to overview that you think also follow these models and are demonstrating success?
I am always working on more than one project. I think the one thing that that I can mention is this angel investment fund that I created with Toyota Partners. It's called Experiential Partners, and we are specifically looking for very early stage startups out there who has that capacity to grow exponentially in the realm of what we call exponential technologies. These are either synthetic biology or digital health companies or 3D printings or AI maybe even autonomous driving type of categories. Any of those areas that will radically improve our daily lives is something that we would love to back, and we also back more than anything those very creative, daring, sometimes crazy entrepreneurs who dare to dream big. We're there to dream big. So, but that's been also consuming a lot of my time, just building that fund, and then constantly looking for new and interesting entrepreneurs out there. So, if you know anyone, please feel free to send their names my way, and we would love to take a look at them.
So, Josh, in describing this Exponential Partners, do you have a website that people could go to and they can sort of get a feel for what you're trying to build?
Yes, it's exponential.vc. So, exponential.vc.
And I guess for the benefit of the audience, let's say I'm working in a company and I've always had entrepreneurial sort of ideas, and or maybe I'm at a university and I'm a researcher, or I'm a grad student, or maybe I'm working in a government institute, I'm entrepreneurial, or even an existing corporation, some of the big technology corporations, and maybe there's people who want to, become an entrepreneur. Do you have some steps that you look at in making an investment? Like, for example, maybe somebody has to put on paper their hypothesis and some sketch of a business plan, and do they submit that to you? Do you go through a series of due diligence, what we call due diligence steps, to kind of vet who they are, what the team members are? Do you have some idea of the kinds of parameters you're looking for, or you want to keep that sort of under the radar at the moment, or do you want to explore any of that?
Yeah, so if you, from the audience, anyone who's, who would like to partner with us, we would love to talk to you, and I would love to talk to them. There is no real hard line criteria per se, other than two things. Number one, we would like to see that company has been backed by outside investors for at least $250,000 before we get involved. So when we get involved, we write for an angel investor relatively big check. So so far, all of our investment have been somewhere between $1 million to $2 million check. So we want to see the entrepreneurs can or has the ability to raise money before us. So that's the one thing that we are pretty seriously looking for. A second thing is, we don't back just a the one page summary based idea, but rather we would like to back someone who's a tinkerer, experimenter, someone who's a doer. So the product has to be beta tested for at least some form of a public setting. So if this is an app, then we want to see a few tens of thousands of users using it, so that we could see the actual the data that shows the interactions, which then can be used as a good validation point. Other than that, there's no really application process that we are trying to seek at this point. And if you come to the website, you could find us, and you could send us an email, and then we will reach back to you. There are other more automated equity-based crowdfunding type of platform that we are building on the side, but that is to come much, much later time. But for the time being, if you want to reach out to us, just come to our website. There's a one contact page that you could use, or I'm sure anyone who's determined, they could find us through LinkedIn and so on.
You know, Josh, if I type in within Microsoft Bing this idea of investment or startup or entrepreneur, I get a list of maybe 500 venture sites or opportunities through funding, whether it's crowdfunding or angel groups or registered VC and so on. So how do you differentiate yourself from all of that noise? What makes your group different?
There are many accelerators and incubators and angel investment networks out there. In fact, we view the future as, or the future of the mankind's innovation, primarily driven by startups. And large corporations today become more of an acquisition machine, and the bulk of the heavy lifting that need to be done in terms of creating that innovation will come from entrepreneurs. So there are a few things that are quite different about us. One is that we take a deep dive. So when we get involved, we do get involved pretty deeply. So we get to know the entrepreneurs way more. We rather take time to get to know them even before we make an investment. So the personal connection aspect is very important to us. Number two, we like local companies. So for obvious reasons, I mean, startup is in spite of being able to go global very quickly, it's a very much a hands-on process. So we like backing companies who are in Southern California. Most well-known household brand startups are all in the Bay Areas, and that's great. But based on our experience, the best entrepreneurs are not geographic dependent. We would like to back companies who are at least in California, and if they are not located nearby, then we would like to find a way to relocate. So that already implies that we're talking to companies who are pretty small, and also would love to work with entrepreneurs who are willing to kind of roll with us. We will help making their transitions. In fact, one of our investments is actually based in Canada, Halifax, Canada, and or Nova Scotia, and we are actually relocating the company to here in Orange County. So that is one example. So we're not an accelerator, nor are we an incubator. We're just very hands-on, entrepreneurial-minded venture capitalist.
Now, Josh, I know a little bit about your history, and the audience will see it in your bio. You do have some, or, when they search your name, they'll know that you have some interest in the YPO and Singularity University, and there's another organization called CEO Organization, and so on. Is there some alignment in terms of what you're trying to do from an entrepreneurship side or from this new investment fund side and your experiences with YPO, CEO, or Singularity University?
Yes, yes, we do. So we have very close relationships with Singularity University. So although we haven't done this yet, it is likely that we'll be in a position to back a few of the SU graduates or companies started by SU graduates. I myself went through a SU program four times, and also I helped create this SU YPO program. That was extremely successful last year, and so we will continue that program again this year. I am also a member of YPO, so a lot of the investors to our fund is also YPOers, and these are kind of battle-proven CEOs themselves. Most of them are entrepreneurs themselves as well, unless they inherited their business holdings from their parents. So we sort of work with our LPs or limited partners very closely, and sometimes these LPs actually do get involved pretty actively with our the investment partners or startup entrepreneurs. We bring that as a one of the key differentiator, and it's a pretty substantial help if you think about it, because YPO has about 23,000 CEO members. Collectively, those member companies contribute more than $1 trillion of total revenue to the global economy. So It is a very powerful organization with a lot of connections, and we bring that to the fund. So that's another area that can clearly set us apart from other, let's say, crowdfunding or equity-based crowdfunding sites out there.
Yeah, I should mention to the audience that YPO is the Young Presidents Organization. So I know sometimes when you're doing a podcast, it could sound like YPO, which is a world IP organization out of Geneva. You know, this is YPO, the Young Presidents Organization. Josh, this interview is somewhat dynamic, and we're actually running over. I know that you you have a hard stop. So is there any closing comments that you want to make, and then we'll end the interview here?
Yeah, one quick comment. Any prospective entrepreneurs who are contemplating becoming an entrepreneur, listening to this podcast, my parting word to you is start now. Do it now and start fast. That was my takeaway, spending all of my 30s building businesses, and my takeaway. And I got the conclusion in the midst of pretty difficult time. That was back in 2008, 2009. And I was talking to myself, I wish I started my business when I was 22, when I graduated from college. And I still stick to that insight. We as the mankind is about to enter into some incredible time. So incredible, so amazing that there's no point waiting to get the amazing corporate jobs, or somehow McKinsey or Goldman Sachs of the world will come and sweep you by your feet and they take you in. Those days are long gone. I think this is the new economy with mainly the doers and entrepreneurs getting their hands dirty and making things happen. So I would highly urge everyone who's listening to this podcast to, get involved and even if it's just a small pet project, I think a consideration for being an entrepreneur. Should start right away, and if possible, take that first step to be an entrepreneur right away.
You know, Josh, that's some really great words of advice. In fact, earlier this year, I spoke at the UN ITU WISIS, the World Summit in Geneva, and it's interesting how this idea of if you've got a pet. The sort of theme that you're looking at, this is the best time to be an entrepreneur because the capital costs are minimal today to get a minimal viable product or to test an idea in the marketplace because of the proliferation of the internet. And I saw the same thing being discussed at the UN. I was invited to speak at the UN in July, and this idea again of innovation, entrepreneurship, startups, helping the economy. Everything's very democratic right now, where anybody can get involved. Your vision that you've had for so long is really the reality today and into the future, and it enables anybody to become a participant and to be the greatest contributor to their countries and to society, which this time has never existed before. And Josh, you're somewhat of a catalyst for all of this, so with all of the work and all of the mentorship and all of the experiences that you've shared. So thank you for coming in today. And I know your schedule is really tight. For you to allocate this kind of time, it's really much appreciated.
You're very welcome. And thank you very much for the invitation. It was a lot of fun.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Josh Hong. Josh is a multi-award-winning global executive, chairman, investor, and serial entrepreneur.